The Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order, and we don't have a quorum now, so we'll hear the bills, and then once we have a quorum, we'll move those bills and lay them over for possible inclusion in supplemental budget bill. President Jacob, before you start, let me just say to those people who are presenting and those members who are here, I think you know that we're hearing looming news about the February budget forecast, and so I think we should be clear that the possibilities of having money to fund some of these projects might be difficult. In fact, we may be in a position where we have to make cuts. And hoping that's not the case, but we have three bills before us, of Jacob, Cornyn, and West, and we'll do those bills and see how things move forward here in the week. Yeah, so Representative Jacob, if you'd like to talk about your bill and introduce your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to have her do more of the talking because I really don't have a voice and I don't really feel well. So, House File 2823 relates to asking for $100,000 from the general fund for a restorative justice program, nonprofit restorative justice program. As we all know, restorative justice is a great tool for prevention for youth and also correcting behavior before it continues further down a criminal, more violent or just a more severe criminal path. So with that, I will let Joanne Ward, who is Executive Director of the South Central Public Restorative Justice Program. Yeah. And I thought he was going to talk, so I was stopping. The Restorative Justice Program, to talk a little bit more about what the program does specifically and what this money would be used for. Thank you.
Do you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Good morning. I'm Joanne Ward. I'm the Executive Director of the South St. Paul Restorative Justice Council. It's a small community organization that started working in schools several years ago, recognizing that many of our programs deal with charged juvenile offenders or juveniles who are facing chargeable offenses. And we feel very strongly that it's important to get to the kids and the families before it gets to that point, whenever possible. So we started conversations with the schools about what do they need. And we developed a program we call Restorative Justice Guides. We've now added culture guides to that title, so the Restorative Justice Culture Guides. And I need to explain first that these are people, not books. I presented last week to the State School Safety Conference as a part of a panel of school interventions. And I think ours is the only program that does regular, daily, we're in the schools all the time, as opposed to episodic presentations. So we are working with students every day to prevent the kinds of things that grow into kids sitting in the office waiting for a principal or an assistant principal or a guidance counselor. Kids can be sitting in the office for hours. They're missing school. They're not getting their problems resolved because no one has time to do anything more than just say, don't do it anymore, or, what's the problem, and we're going to have to fix this. And it tends to be kind of punitive. It tends to be sometimes getting to the level of expulsion or suspension, detention after school, those kinds of things. Instead, we sit down with students, and sometimes it only takes 5-15 minutes for someone to listen to what's going on in their lives. And there are a lot of children who are, most children are dealing with a lot of things that we didn't have to deal with when we were growing up. And these things are weighing heavily on their hearts and minds and prevent them from learning. It interferes with the learning environment for the whole school. The principals have testified for us to say that this is the best bang for the buck of anything that they do in the school district. But as schools are dealing with less and less funding, it's going to be more and more challenging for us to be able to fund this program. Being in the school for just a few hours a day even makes a big difference. We have, in 2.5 to 3 hours a day, we have dropped the incidence of violence and disruptive behavior reports to the school, to the administration, by 50%. The kids are back in the classroom much more quickly. They're back in their classroom being productive, engaging. We all know how social engagement, how the kids being connected to the school is really important to their success in school. And if they're not feeling safe because they don't have anyone to talk to, they don't have anyone that they can really connect with, an adult who's trusted beyond the classroom teacher who doesn't have time, then things go downhill. And what we found is that it makes a significant difference in truancy. So the kids are in school, they feel safer, they want to come to the classroom, they're ready to learn in a better way because they know that they can be helped. We don't solve their problems for them. We help them connect with their own inner wisdom and learn some skills to resolve whatever it is they're dealing with. We do end up calling child protection. We do end up calling for special services for these families because we hear things that no one else knows about. And so the kids are getting better help at an earlier stage. That doesn't happen terribly often simply because we're able to resolve the problems before they get to that point. But I know that you are probably familiar with the YIPA funds, and that's really dealing with kids further down the road. But the YIPA interventions, the Youth Intervention Programs Association, which we also are members of and participate in with the charged and chargeable offenses, do save the taxpayer and the community's money because we're preventing the need for social services, we're keeping kids and families connected into the community in safer ways, kids are learning in school. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Ms. Ward, what's the name of your program?
It's the South St. Paul Restorative Justice Council.
What you described didn't sound like what I would typically think of as restorative justice, so
mm-hmm.
when we've usually heard about restorative justice programs, it's been when someone has gotten in trouble and there's a, what they call a justice circle.
Right.
And trying to, but this sounds like, I'm not hearing that, if this is, is this a variation of that, or
actually, it's the foundation for it, for what you're familiar with. Indigenous people all over the world have used what we term in the Western world restorative justice or restorative practices as a way of being in community, as a way of making community decisions, solving problems, but also celebrating. So it's a way of being together and resolving issues, social norming, keeping the community together in less legalistic ways. So as we might imagine a community sitting in circle to deal with a problem. But it doesn't have to be to the level of chargeable offense. A child is having a problem. And in this case, we don't necessarily need a circle of people. We can have one person who can sit down with this child and maybe the other child or children that they're having trouble with. Sometimes we meet with one, sometimes we meet with half a dozen or 10 kids. And usually we do it over their lunch hours so that they're not missing class. Often they're not even missing recess. We just sit and have lunch together. You may be familiar with class or with schools who have an adult sit with kids at lunch and maybe have more of a family style lunch period, and how that impacts the behavior, the culture of the community. It's that social adult connection that really can make a big difference for kids. Restorative justice really is the full spectrum, not just criminal behavior, whether it's adults or children. It really starts in the family. So as we're teaching kids some of these skills, we're encouraging them to know that they can use these things everywhere they go. They can use them, and they do. They pull out talking pieces, or they pick up a rock to use as a talking piece on the playground. You know, what are the rules of the game? And people have disagreements, and rather than fighting about it, they learn how to sort out their problems in a more respectful and calm manner. So they don't get to the fight. They don't get to the big problems, either in the classroom or in the hallways or on the playground. And the teachers refer the kids to us. Somebody's having problems. These kids are, you know, gnashing at each other all of the time and can't quit talking or fighting all the time. They've got something going on, and I can't figure out what it is. Can you help me? And we'll spend 15 minutes with them, and it might be 15 or 20 minutes several days in a row to sort it all out. The sooner we get to it, you know, the faster that goes. Does that help?
Yes, it does. And so why doesn't the school district, I mean, you primarily work in the schools, why doesn't the school district, or do they provide any funding for your services?
They have recently. We actually started out experimenting with this as volunteers. We worked for over a year as volunteers in the school, and that allowed us to understand the best way to approach this and whether or not we could be effective, and it was kind of experimental, but there were a couple of us who were committed to it, really believed in it. So it's not a curriculum-based program. It's really a philosophy, and as circles are, it's a practice. And the school district has picked up some funding. We get a little bit of funding from the diversity program, the EMID money, because we go to the classrooms and work with kids on culture issues. We'll do classroom circles or small group circles. As you are, you know, if you think about conflict, it often revolves around differences. And we're in a particularly rapidly changing demographic area, as much of the state is. And differences come up all the time. So the school district has been funding us. That's not likely to happen. We don't get a lot of money. It's a very little bit of money. And the organization is primarily funded through grants from foundations. This is on a shoestring. And with the cuts that are going to be coming, it's not likely we're going to be able to fund this program next year. And beyond that, part of the idea is that we could be a pilot for the state. We've been doing this long enough. We have some statistics. We'd like to be able to put some more together that would allow us to document this more solidly. Beyond, we've got some statistics and we've got lots of anecdotes, but we'd like to be able to solidify that and then be able to help other districts use this as well. It's very powerful.
Do you have any questions? Okay, Ms. Ward, thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Bigham, do you have anything else to add?
No, just appreciate the committee's time and consideration if there is any money.
Okay, very good.
And that, Mr. Chair, this bill proves that I want to put everybody in prison.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. Let's.
Thank you very much.
Representative Cornish, okay. We still don't have a quorum, so I'm not going to move this bill either. Representative Cornish, House File 2863.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to send some articles around. On the inside of the newspaper, we've got the section on the center here, and then we'll have to back.
I hope you don't. But that's okay.
You can use it. On your back to your coffin.
Just roll it up and throw it on my porch. You'll be fine. Gas tax.
You can go into old news. You can go into 50 cents for one, 50 cents for all.
It's the budget doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
What are we looking for? We're trying to hear Bill. You sit down. Maybe we could. Representative Cornish, are you ready?
Mr. Chairman, House File 2863. I was wondering if I could. You notice there's a blank appropriation. I'd like to make an oral amendment if I could.
Representative Cornish, we need one more member before we can really officially do anything, so maybe we can hear your bill and someone will drift in here and we'll have a quorum and then we'll fill in that blank.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'll provide a little color while the technical things get worked out here. What you have here, Mr. Chair and members, is a request for appropriation for what's called Welcome Manor. When you open your packets and take a look at the center, this is the high school that I graduated from, and which has now been remodeled and renovated. And if you look at that picture of the front over in the far left corner is where I spend a lot of my time in the principal's office. But the high school closed some time ago, and Roxy Brandt, who is the owner sitting in the chairs here to my right, and a partner of hers, Dan Wingard, have put their own money and time into it. And Mr. Chair, so far they have put $2.5 million of their own money into this building and renovating it, and it's inhabited right now with a number of clients that they receive. The clients come to this are chemically dependent women with children, and it's one of the few centers like this around that take care of not only the mother but the children with them. And it's in operation now, and like I said, they put about $2.5 million of their own money into it. The times are they're getting stretched now because historically with these type of centers it takes a while for them to fill up. I can think it can hold as many as 30 mothers with children, and right now they've got about 8 or 9, and I haven't checked with them just lately, but it takes so many to break even. But as these people come in, it takes a while to fill it up, and so we're requesting a $250,000 of appropriation to the state to be issued out as a grant, and that's how this request or this house file is written. And now I'll turn it over to Gwen, who will lead you through the presentation of what the center does.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yep, my name is Gwen Walters, and I am the coordinator at Welcome Manor Family Services. We are a nonprofit organization located in Garden City, which is about 10 miles south of Mankato. And our program was initially set up to serve a niche that wasn't being served. Our program is capable of holding up to 30 women, and we are also capable of holding at a minimum 32 children in our daycare plus our school-age children. So what our facility does really is we serve women who are chemically dependent, and while they're here with us in treatment, they have the opportunity to bring their children with them. We have both a primary program and an extended care program. During primary, mom will receive between 5 and 6 hours of treatment counseling each day. And during extended care, it's reduced a little bit to between 4, maybe 4.5 hours. And that time that is left over is spent doing parenting skills. And so the goal of our program is to not only address the chemical abuse issues that mom faces, but also to reincorporate her with her children in a safe setting. The children are in our licensed daycare while mom is in treatment in the same building. So all of our services are on site, which makes it a lot easier for moms to come into treatment and get the help that they need. And when I first started, we're filling a niche, or we're filling a gap, because what would happen is mom would either not seek treatment because she's the sole provider for her children, and didn't want to leave her children, and in lieu of getting help for herself, she would try and live through that and suffer through that. Or her children would go to a foster care system. And so with us having both of them together, it'll save resources in that system, so that the criminal justice piece of it, the probation piece of it, and the foster care system can have that reduction, because they're all safe in one facility. The other thing that we really want to do is make sure that we give these women and children life lessons and tools that they can use when they're done with our program. Simple things, from making sure that you know how to give your child a bath, to nutrition and eating well and exercise, and things that a lot of us will take for granted but are very important. We really want to start all over with a clean slate, so that they can get the help and the tools necessary to be good moms again. You know, they deserve a chance to get that life back that they were wanting before. People don't wake up in the morning and decide, I'm going to go down to the corner and buy some crack, and I'm going to be an addict for the rest of my life. So our program has really been set up so that we can give those kinds of services along with the services for the children.
Ms. Walters, we're not going to make the amendment on the appropriation now, but how much are you actually seeking from the state?
$250,000.
That was a struggle, Mr. Chair, members, to come up with. That was a struggle to come up with, because naturally their inclination is to ask for more, but the realization with the tight funding, and I'm kind of proud of them in the fact that all that $2.5 million so far is none of it's state money, it's all private money, and this is the first time that they've come and asked for help, and we're having difficulty in acquiring some grants, and because of the special nature of the situation here. And so,
I didn't understand where is the existing funding coming? Maybe I didn't hear.
What
current funding for this,
current funding is all private, operational and structural. They've paid for it all themselves. And now the problem is we've run to the limit of the stretching the finances of the funding, and until we get the 30 people in where it starts to pay for itself, that's the struggle they're having right now, is getting critical funding mass.
Yeah, and are any of the clients, any of the women ordered by the court too?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get any reimbursement from the county or the state for that?
Right now what's happening is we have space for 30 women. Right now we have 10 women there, and we have 12 children. Some of the clients that come to us will come county-funded. Some will come self-pay, and some will come through insurance companies. And so with the county funding, there is a gap between when they start their services and when we can actually start billing for those services, which sometimes isn't until the end of the first month that they're there, and sometimes it's not until the end of their entire program. Primary care is about a month in length, and the extended care is a minimum of 60 days and can be extended to 4 months to 6 months, depending on what their needs are, and what level of funding they're available for. With insurance companies, it's sometimes difficult to get that funding source online. So, you know, there's a certain amount of things that need to be done in that regard, and we certainly are working towards that as well. The program itself is set up so that we can recoup some costs through the daycare program, but that's about $100 a week. So it's very nice to help pay for some of those daycare costs. However, it doesn't take care of the overall big picture. And what I gave you all copies of is there's a copy of our brochure. There's also a disc, which is what I'm trying to load on this wonderful laptop. So if I can't get that going, you do have the disc. And what it is it's a picture or several pictures of our building and our facility. And the disc and my conversations don't necessarily do it justice. And so I would invite any and all of you, if you want more information, I did put my business card in there with our web address, and there is this information on the website as well. Is it on there? Okay. We do also have conversations with our local school district. We have the opportunity to have our school-age children be bused over to Lake Crystal Welcome Memorial School District so that they can be incorporated into that school system while they're coming to school. So really trying to show these kids some normalcy and some routine so that they can take those healthy routines and utilize those when they get home.
Okay, Representative Cornish, we now have a quorum. So the chair will move House File 2863. Actually, why don't you move your own bill since you're on the committee?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 2863.
Okay, and then why don't you move your amendment to Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to amend House File 2863 in line 1.6 to insert $250,000 in the blank for the appropriation.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay, now we're back. Do you have your PowerPoint presentation or is it not working?
I do. I can see it.
Okay.
Should we all come up there?
I can see it and I...
Is this on our end that the problem is or...
Can we just try it again?
Mr. Chair, I don't think it's going to work, so we'll just hang around afterwards if somebody wants to look through. And otherwise, I think the same thing is in the packet.
Yeah, the same disc is in your packet. And then there, in the bigger packet, there's just some bulleted points about our program and what we do, and that is the disc that is on here. So are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have one more. I mean, I believe most of the treatment-oriented appropriations come from the Health and Human Services Committee, so this is a little new, I think, to this committee. So where do most treatment centers, how much money do most treatment centers get? Are they able to, are they surviving primarily on state funds, or what?
Primarily, and you are correct, it normally comes from Department of Human Services through a grant. Unfortunately, it isn't a grant funding year for them right now, and so we did request an unsolicited grant through DHS, and unfortunately, just recently was denied. So there isn't any funding available through them at this point. That's exactly where it would come from.
So you requested money for this year, and it was denied, and so are you going to apply again? We do have someone that can maybe fix the...
Oh!
I can try anyway.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to get a connection to public safety here. Are some of the young women that come to this program, are they in some kind of a diversion program for ordered by the courts? Is that kind of the reason this is there?
Yep. We do have clients that come to us that are court ordered to be there, and oftentimes it's the last opportunity for them to prove themselves to the courts so that they can remain with their children. And so it's a program that is really quite necessary in building that link, and trying to put as many services together as possible. Not only with the reunification of mom and children, but also between other family members. And so I would say that the link between us and public safety would be utilizing those services to maximize the benefits, so that we can get help for these moms so that they aren't reoffending. Oftentimes substance abuse comes with criminal backgrounds and criminal behavior and those sorts of things, and we really want to try and make that circle whole again.
That's not easy. Still not working? Okay. Well, are there any other questions? Hey, you got it.
Oh. Well, it's up to you, Mr. Chair, if you have time to fade through the pictures.
We've got time if you'd like to. Is it going now?
I love that one.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions while we're waiting?
No, I think at this time we'll, why don't Representative Bigham, why don't you move your House file?
Mr. Chair, I will move House File 2831 to be laid over consideration.
Yes.
Oh, where are we moving it to?
2823.
Your bill.
Your bill? Would you move your bill, House File 2823?
Oh, didn't I say 2823? What did I say?
More than a different number than that.
Oh, my bad. 2823. Okay. I'll move that. I'll move my bill. 2823.
Ill today, so we.
I am. I am, and I have a ruptured eardrum, so I can't really hear either.
Jeez. Okay. Okay. So Representative Bigham moved House File 2823. Now the chair will lay over House File 2823 for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then can I get a motion to approve the minutes of February 19th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch moves the minutes of February 19th. Is there any discussion, changes? Here's none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay, so I guess we won't see the PowerPoint presentation.
It is very nice, though. So if you do have a minute, it is in the little disc, and then it's also online. So if you do have a minute to check that out. And just note, Welcome Manor is spelled with two L's, so when you go look at it online, it's two L's in Welcome.
Very good. Well, Ms. Walters, thank you for your testimony. And Representative Cornish, the chair will lay over House File 2863 for possible inclusion in the public in the supplemental budget bill. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Representative Lesch, the last bill on the agenda is House File 3231.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a fantastic PowerPoint presentation too, but couldn't get it to work, so I'm just not going to bring it down. But trust me, it was great.
You want to move your bill, Representative?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair, move House File 3231.
Very good.
And Mr. Chair, members, thank you. If I may begin.
Yes, you may.
Okay. Please do. Members of the committee may recall this from last year. Members, this is a situation where government, I think, does its best, in that it takes a system that's already been put in place by law enforcement and other individuals in the committee who understand the problem of homelessness and develop a system on their own, bottom up, on how best to address this. And it brings in the participation of us at the state level to show how, in fact, we can perpetuate this. And with that,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 3231. For the record, my name is Patrick Arden Wood. I'm the state policy advocate for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And with me this morning,
somewhere,
is Monica Nielsen, who is the outreach director for St. Stephen's Human Services in Minneapolis. I'm going to start out by giving some background regarding the bill before you, and Ms. Nielsen will follow to give testimony about how such a project looked on the ground in terms of collaboration with police and consequent efficiencies and cost savings. Afterwards, we'll be glad to answer any questions. First, let me go quickly over the contents of your packet. Included is the final report to the legislature regarding the Homeless Outreach Pilot Project grant. A transcription of testimony to the Senate Public Safety Budget Division delivered last winter by Senior Commander John Zamastic, who is the commander of the Central District in St. Paul, where one of these projects operates, and letters of support from Laura Cadwell, the director of Governor Pawlenty's initiative, the Business Plan to End Long-Term Homelessness in Minnesota, and others. Also included in your packet is the Coalition Policy Brief on the expansion of the Police Provider Project, and one of a number of articles that have appeared recently in metro area media regarding the Minneapolis Outreach Collaborative, and a photograph about which I will say more later. A little bit of history. In 2005, in response to increasing concern on the part of providers and advocacy groups regarding the criminalization of homelessness and the increased barriers to housing that criminalization created for many homeless individuals, the legislature funded a modest pilot project in the Office of Justice Programs to evaluate the effectiveness of intentional partnerships between police and service providers to ensure that homeless individuals who had frequent contact with police, courts, detox centers, and other costly high-end services were receiving appropriate, coordinated, and cost-effective interventions rather than cycling through the same system over and over with no positive tangible results. Now, let me be clear here that we're not talking about giving a pass to people who commit serious offenses. We're talking about people who are frequently cited for what are normally referred to as livability crimes related to homelessness, public intoxication, disruptive behavior, manifestations of scary behavior related to untreated mental health issues, aggressive panhandling, public urination, etc. Behaviors that I don't want my daughter to have to deal with, but not necessarily behaviors that require the expenditure of valuable police resources. I urge you to review Commander Zamastic's testimony regarding this point. The intention of the grant were multifold. One, to reduce long-term homelessness. To reduce the cost and time that law enforcement spent dealing with what are essentially social service issues, and to promote stronger and safer communities by connecting problematic homeless people to appropriate services and housing. While the project looked at homeless people in general, the specific focus was to provide services to those homeless folk who were experiencing mental health, chemical dependency issues, and traumatic brain injury. I'd like to explain the significance of these particular populations. The Wilder Research Center does a survey of homeless individuals in Minnesota every 3 years, and we've been seeing some disturbing trends in the homeless population over time. We're seeing more people who have been diagnosed with mental health disorders, 52% in 2006 as opposed to 20% in 1994. There's a stubborn persistence of chemical health disorders, which probably doesn't come as a surprise, and evidence of traumatic brain injury in approximately 30% of the homeless adult population. And this indication of traumatic brain injury, which affects the executive functions of the brain and makes it difficult for people to get from A to B in terms of decision making and figuring out what to do, heretofore hasn't been tracked, but as you can imagine, it poses significant clinical challenges to effective work with these individuals. The initial public safety grants were awarded to Minneapolis, Hennepin County, St. Paul, Ramsey County, and Duluth, St. Louis County. They were stipulated to be two metro area grants and one grant in greater Minnesota. Each project took a slightly different tack appropriate to the needs of their local circumstances, but were evaluated on common outcomes. The programs were unquestionably successful, with, as you can see in the final report, significant decreases in key indicators such as detox admission, arrests, and achievement of permanent housing. The percentage is impressive, but we're not talking about poster kids here. So when you consider the acuity of the population, yes. It's also worth noting that the St. Paul Project was awarded the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's Partners Award for ending long-term homelessness in its first year of collaboration. The executive director of the U.S. Interagency Task Force on Homelessness, Phil Mangano, has visited the St. Paul program and cites it as a national model. As a result of the success of the pilot project, which you can review in your packet, the programs were refunded for the 08-09 biennium. Last summer, I had the opportunity to organize and participate in community meetings with cities and counties in greater Minnesota, particularly with Fargo-Moorhead, St. Cloud, Mankato, and Rochester. All four had submitted thoughtful and comprehensive applications for the outreach grants, and I found continued commitment on the part of police and providers to obtain necessary funding to replicate these pilot programs in a manner that made sense for their needs and for their communities. Because of the strong interest in a more creative and cost-effective fashion by these communities in greater Minnesota, the Board of the Coalition elected to include support in our legislative agenda for expansion of these grants to these communities. They've already done major planning for such programs. They believe that these programs would aid in their efforts to deal with the hardest to serve homeless folks that they encounter on a daily basis, and they envision these programs as a critical building block in their 10-year plans to end long-term homelessness. Now, as an aside, before I took on this current role with the Coalition for the Homeless, I spent approximately 25-plus years starting and running outreach programs like this for homeless mentally ill, chemically dependent adults who live outside in Detroit, in Minneapolis, and St. Paul. I've consulted with outreach programs throughout the state of Minnesota and Michigan, and I've always believed that there was a natural synergy between police and social service outreach workers. Historically, these two professions have been suspicious of one another, but once you break through the stereotypes, there's a lot of crossover in terms of the populations that they serve. Once you work through the preconceptions, a lot of exciting, innovative, cost-effective collaborations can develop. I would reference Commander Vanasic's testimony again on this point. And I say this as the only outreach worker I've ever met who's been shot by the police while doing his job. Finally, the photograph. In the back of your packet is a photograph. That photograph was taken on January 14th of this year. We could spend a great deal of time talking about the dollar costs of homelessness, but this is the real cost of homelessness. Wasted lives, wasted potential. Somebody's child, somebody's brother. Vernon Wigland worked as an insulator, never had a bad word to say about anybody. He drank too much. He was homeless. He was a longtime visitor of the bishop in Fargo. He's well known in Fargo and Moorhead. I personally never want to find another dead body, another homeless person living outside. I never want to have to explain to my daughter again why this can happen in the richest country in the world. I want this to end. With that, I'd like to turn testimony over to Monica Nielsen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Monica Nielsen, and I am Director of Outreach at St. Stephen's Human Services in Minneapolis. A homeless man is brushing his teeth in a drinking fountain in a downtown business. What does the employee do? He calls the police. What do the police do? They give him a ticket. That same person is sleeping on your neighbor's property. What does your neighbor do? He calls the police. What do the police do? He gives him a ticket. Now that same person is scaring you as he swears to himself walking down the street, then asks for change, then swears to the sky. What do? You call the police. What do the police do? In the case of a man named Daryl, he received 102 tickets before we tried something different. 102 tickets. Since the police department referred him to an outreach worker 5 months ago, and that worker walked him to the path of housing, how many tickets has he received? Zero. Day after day, zero, week after week, zero, now 5 months later when we tried something different. We didn't have an alternative. All we could do was call the police. The police didn't have an alternative. All they could do was give him a ticket. Some nights, he would warrant a booking and a night in jail. The cost? $363. Other nights, Daryl would seek his housing elsewhere. But perhaps one night he would take a poor man's vacation and get drunk. The cost of a night in detox, $192. Or maybe he would have quote-unquote back pain and have to spend the night at a hospital. The cost, $2,800. If there was a shelter bed open and he stayed in, he'll stay at a cost of $32 a night. Or maybe he sleeps outside, and his only cost is his interaction with the police at $30 an hour per patrol officer. Among our options, spending nothing is not one of them. With the development of an outreach team working in partnership with local law enforcement, the police have a choice. Spend their time with the homeless person or work with an outreach worker to find a longer-term solution. Today, what is the rent for Daryl to be staying in supportive housing for people who have been homeless? $10 per night. We are not asking for help. Local law enforcement and homeless advocates have the solutions, and they are more cost-efficient than our current choices. Individuals who are identified as chronic offenders or community livability issues are referred by the police to outreach teams. The outreach teams are charged with reducing the amount of time police must spend on homeless issues, the number of arrests they make, and the number of homeless victims of crime. Further, outreach teams respond to citizen calls on public issues of homelessness, panhandling, people wandering in their mental illness, people sleeping under the bridge. Outreach teams are further decreasing public costs by partnering with the courts to establish long-term plans under a judge's supervision, with the outcome a reduction in court costs. If the choice is working with an outreach worker or going to the workhouse for a year, you'd be surprised how many people are eager to work with me. With my project, $47,000 a year from the state has leveraged over $300,000 in just 4 months, with an additional $180,000 anticipated in federal, local, and private funding. Our choice is not whether there will be a cost to addressing homeless issues in the public arena. The choice is whether it will be a law enforcement response with a short-term outcome or a response by an outreach worker whose job it is to house them and get them off the street. $30 an hour for a patrol officer or $17 an hour for an outreach worker. $363 in jail tonight or $10 at home tonight. You get to choose. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Mr. Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I take it that you're not in favor of the proposal from one city a few years ago that the third urination in public be treated as a felony?
Were you asking a question, or were you just...
Was it a question of the author? Not to me, no, Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory. I would not be in favor of that.
Mr. Wood, I guess the connection with this committee with public safety and trying to intervene and work in collaboration with law enforcement, so I understand why it's here, but are you getting other housing funds to operate the outreach program for Minnesota Housing Finance? Or, I mean, there's a significant amount of housing money out there. I'm just wondering if this is your only source of state money.
The projects that are currently existing have been able to leverage housing vouchers from MHFA and have been able to leverage funds from the Partners Fund to obtain rental assistance. But other than collaboration with existing programs, no, we don't have enough housing. We don't have enough supportive housing.
Thank you. Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank Pat Wood for bringing this forward, but more so for your cooperation and counsel with Stearns County and State College. You often come to visit us. We had a program put in on Stearns County with the Veterans Hospital about 5 years ago, where a social worker works the street both from the Veterans Hospital and from Stearns County and their office, and is actually on the street in the libraries, in the restaurants, in the bus stops. And that has made the homeless people real people, and has taken them out of the shadows and has somebody that has a name and can communicate. And the police go directly to the street advocate to help with the problem, and it has really helped an awful lot. So these programs, if you put that type of energy, really do work. And if you keep it in the police force and jail systems, it's very expensive and it doesn't work that well. Thank you.
Representative Lesh, are these three areas? Three additional areas, are they up and ready to go?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could first to answer the question, my understanding is yes, they are. But number two, I did want to point out a response to some of the other questions that this is a novel approach to addressing the problem of homelessness and long-term homelessness. And people may remember that 3 years ago, the governor proposed $28 million into a long-term homelessness alleviation project. But that was in the wake of about $1 billion in cuts in Health and Human Services, many of which went toward the problem of long-term homelessness. And around about the number of $28 million was just the amount that was cut from the bricks and mortar for housing in the 03 budget cutting year to solve long-term homelessness problems. We're not moving back in this direction with approach. With this approach, we're using a novel approach whereby we can nip this in the bud at the front end, where people don't have to avail themselves of those services.
Any other questions? Mr. Wood, Mr. Nielsen, thank you for your testimony. I think you heard me earlier where we don't know what's going to happen. Money is short this year. We provided money in the bill last year and hope we can expand services throughout the state, but we'll just have to see how things shake out. So thanks for your testimony, Representative Lesch. I'll lay, unless you have any closing comments, I'm going to lay House File 3231 on the table for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. I don't think we have anything else on the agenda. We're not meeting tomorrow. Representative Mullery, are you going to, you're going to take our time tomorrow? Is that it? So those of you who are on public safety policy, we'll be meeting at 8 o'clock?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it'll be the agenda from last
year. Okay, the policy committee has many more bills than we do, so we are loaning Representative Mullery some days.
It's No.
If there's nothing else, then I'll...
Isn't that true when I do?
Adjourn the meeting, Representative Murphy.
I'll tell you.